So, good morning, everyone. Welcome. When Adam was here for a couple of weeks, one of the things he asked me if I'd be willing to write on the topic of what is Zen. And I said yes to that. I mean, mainly because I think that it's such an important question. It's you know, really important in my mind that people who are interested, curious, exploring, have these fundamental questions answered, no matter how difficult that may be. And this is a difficult one, or at least it is for me. So what I have here today is sort of a draft of that, and so in the end, I'm going to ask for feedback, because it also feels like quite a responsibility to respond to a question that's that essential in a relatively public forum. So starting out with a quote from Hakuin Zenji. A special teaching without scriptures, beyond words and letters, pointing to the mind essence of man, seeing directly into one's nature, attaining enlightenment. Several years ago, I was asked to speak about Zen as part of an interfaith panel at a local high school. I found it to be uniquely challenging to present the basic concepts of our way in a manner that would make sense to young inquiring minds. I think that one of the great barriers to reaching a broader audience for Zen is that it can seem incomprehensible, mystical, and inscrutable when described in language. Although that is far from the truth. Perhaps one consequence of this relatively obscure appearance is that a very significant proportion of this Zen students in this country come from the intelligentsia. Generally speaking, these more educated persons are comfortable with the relatively opaque expressions and with complex metaphoric language, and are therefore willing to penetrate beyond those to experience Zen's reality. In fact, this dilemma is an ancient one, going back to Shakyamuni Buddha and beyond. The experience of awakening to true nature, of seeing this great reality as it really is, of entering profound non-separation with the whole universe, simply cannot be expressed linguistically with any fidelity to the actual experience. Just as we cannot adequately describe the color red to a blind person, or the taste of a fresh June strawberry to someone who has no sense of taste. This very same problem arises when we begin to examine the question, what is Zen? How do we begin to talk about something that is beyond words and letters, seeing directly into the mind essence of man? On one level, we can't. Hakuin has done a remarkable job of offering what may be the clearest and most concise answer to the question of what is Zen. In essence, what Hakuin is saying is that Zen is fundamentally a process of profound inward-facing inquiry. However, that inquiry is usually in response to a question. The question can vary from person to person, but it is always one of the great existential questions. What is life all about? Who am I? What is my relationship to the universe? What is my true nature? Why do I suffer so in my life? It is our question that provides the impetus for our inquiry, our practice. Of course, the question isn't always something we consciously formulate and can articulate. It can be far more amorphous, such as having the feeling of being disconnected from the world around us, or a sense that our suffering isn't inevitable, that there is a greater possibility for our lives. At the early stage of our practice, our nascent impulse towards practice is often strengthened by reading about Zen. while ours is a practice that is beyond words and letters, there's a tremendous amount written about Zen. And I suspect that most people in this culture have their first encounter with Zen through the written word. That's quite all right. Reading about Zen can inform and deepen our impulse to begin practice. However, we must also very clearly understand that reading about Zen is not Zen. Even if we read every book about Zen, we will still be light years from ever understanding Zen if we don't also engage in the work of looking into the mind essence and seeing directly into our own nature. We must assiduously pursue that inquiry, and the method through which we must pursue that is Zazen, Zen meditation. On his deathbed, the Buddha gave us the teaching of Atthadipa. Look within. You are the light itself. Rely on yourself. Do not rely on others. The Dharma is the light. Rely on the Dharma. Do not rely on anything other than the Dharma. Whether we sit shikantaza, count our breaths, or do koan study, we cannot have Zen without Zazen, without the inquiry, without looking deeply into our own mind. Ultimately, we must be willing to spend years on this inward journey, practicing with great diligence, if we are to see the truth of what Zen is all about. No one can do that work for us. No teacher can give us anything that we don't already have. We must discover it for ourselves through all of the trials and tribulations that arise over the course of a lifetime of practice. However, while the Buddha says that we must rely on ourselves, does not mean we can do this practice alone and without the guidance of a teacher or the presence of a community, a sangha. The three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha must be present for there to be Zen. There is a reason that we refer to them as treasures. They are the elements which must be present to guide and sustain our practice. When any one of these pillars of practice is missing, the whole structure is unsound. In this context, I believe that Buddha, the term Buddha here, refers to both our inherent but as yet unawakened Buddha nature and to the presence and guidance of a teacher. By a teacher, I mean someone who has rigorously pursued this Zen path, usually for several decades, under the guidance of their teacher. Ultimately, through the process of Dharma transmission, that teacher has acknowledged that their student has realized their true nature and they are ready to teach others. This process of transmission has been the means of preserving the authenticity of the teachings, the Dharma, for 2,500 years. Now, I know that there have been times and places where the integrity of this transmission process has been questionable, as well as instances where teachers have behaved in manners that were harmful and contrary to the Zen precepts, causing some people to question the authenticity of their teaching authority. I am also aware that there are persons who therefore question the validity of Zen transmission and are reticent to engage with any teacher. However, Dogen Zenji taught that doing Zazen without the guidance of a teacher was worse than not sitting at all, and I find that I agree with that. The pitfalls along the path of practice are numerous, and simultaneously they can be very subtle. We cannot see the webs that are skillfully woven by our own ego. We cannot do the work of loosening our attachments and delusions alone. We must have a teacher. The fact that there have been flaws in the transmission process and that a small percentage of teachers have behaved unconscionably does not negate the fact that the vast majority of transmissions are authentic and the vast majority of teachers are highly scrupulous persons who work diligently to maintain the precepts in their lives and to convey them to others. However, that doesn't mean that a student should abandon caution and good common sense when entering the relationship with a teacher. Another whole talk could be written on this subject, but for the purposes of this discussion, I am reminded of what my teacher, Steph Barragato, used to say, never give your power away. Be careful. Vet the teacher thoroughly. Find a place to practice where you feel comfortable and safe. That is absolutely essential. Don't settle for less. But if you want to see what Zen is all about, you must ultimately begin to practice with a teacher who has received Dharma transmission in a recognized lineage. Then gradually, as the practice deepens over time, the bond of trust between the teacher and student should grow so that the powerful synergy of teaching and practice emerges until in the later stages of practice, the distinction between teacher and student vanishes. The term Dharma is variously applied to the formal teachings of Buddhism and to the path of practice that we follow. However, while our practices have evolved over the time that has passed since the Buddha was alive, in Zen particularly, they are a dynamic entity that need to respond to the conditions of time, place, and person. It is the part of the job of Zen teachers to assure that our practice maintains its relevance, that our forms do not become stagnant, falling into lackluster rote repetition. True Zen must be alive, continually challenging students, dragging them out of their comfort zone, and guarding against their forming attachments. When sutra study became the dominant form of practice in China, Bodhidharma responded by facing a wall for 9 years, asserting the primary importance of Zazen, seated Zen meditation. Perhaps for Americans who have a tendency to favor informality over formal rigor and whose iconoclastic tendencies cause us to shy away from devotional practice, those teachers who are maintaining a precise liturgical practice are providing the right medicine for this time and place. On the other hand, if the attachment to form begins to become too widespread, perhaps wild mountain Zen, that is more influenced by our Taoist route, will be called for. If our Zen practice is authentic, it will never allow us to become a place of comfort where our ego can abide and set down its roots. Our teachers, and ultimately we ourselves, must constantly dig down and tear these roots out. Zen is a tree that must constantly blow about freely in the winds of time. Finally, there is Sangha, the community of practice. Anyone who has tried to sustain a strong and regular practice apart from the support of such a community has probably learned how difficult that can be. When a Sangha is harmonious, when students support one another through the difficult hours of a session, when there is no competition and jealousy, when the whole community maintains the practice with great care, Zen flourishes. Ultimately, though, whatever our Zen is, we must come to the place where it is no more. At that point, flowers bloom in the summer, leaves turn in the fall, snow blankets the ground in winter, and new grasses come forth in the spring.
Can I ask one question first? What about all those people who do not have teachers, who are practicing? How can we deny that they are...
They're practicing something. I'm just saying they're not practicing Zen. I mean, again, Dogen felt that strongly about it, to say that it was worse than not sitting at all. And I kind of share that view, as I said, you know, in part because there's so many traps out there. The heavenly being one, for example, being one that a lot of people fall into that are practicing on their own, you know. They are Buddhists. They have no anger. They are in love and light and, you know, and all, you know, there's sort of that part of it. But just in general, you know, I mean, it's so hard to root out our attachments and delusions, and they come back continually. And so it's so easy to get in sort of stuck places. It's so easy to get into a practice that doesn't challenge us at all. You know, if all you do is sit for 20 years and count breaths, how much work on your attachments and delusions are you doing? How often are you challenging yourself with the precepts? You know, my view is that it is extremely hard, if not impossible, to kind of maintain that focus, that intensity on our own. And so you get people say, oh, I've been sitting for 30 years. Well, good. I'm not saying there's necessarily inherently something wrong with that. But that's not the same as being engaged in Zen practice for 30 years. Very different. Very different.
However, I still struggle with the idea of that it's worse than not practicing at all. You know? And for me, that sitting before Zen is what led me here.
I think it's a trap, that language that he's using, if we take that too literally.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, he's making comparative judgments, and he's doing it. He's making a statement to shake us out of complacency.
Maybe it could be restated. Maybe it should be if a person's goal is realization. In other words, if your goal is stress reduction, then maybe it's perfectly fine to sit forever without a teacher. Because it will do that, right? We know that. We can put the little things on, do the galvanic skin response and the pulse and all those things. And if you don't have to sit with a teacher to have those stress physiological and psychological stress reducing responses. But I think if your goal is realization, then it's really impossible. You know, and sometimes the lightning strikes. I mean, there's some people who never sit, and we've been talking about that kind of this morning. You know, that this not everybody who's enlightened has practiced Zen, and I've been people who really had this like lightning strike thing. It's just had deep awake, profound awakenings that have been confirmed by teachers that. I had no sitting background. It happens, but kind of like all, you know, so there's like any generalization, there are exceptions, but it's kind of like, rather than go to work on Monday, buy a lottery ticket, you know, because if you have a lottery ticket, you've got the one chance in a million, so why bother going to your job, you know? Most of us need to go to our job and make the paycheck come in, you know, and we don't sit around waiting to see if we win the lottery. But there are people who do that. Yeah.
Well, there's also people who get enlightened without the discipline and don't know what to do with it. And you know, as the enlightenment experience comes and the Zen teacher says, okay, go cut broccoli, go chop wood. Don't hang on to that. So it's pretty hard to let go of an enlightenment experience unless you have the discipline of letting go, letting go, letting go every, 50 times every time you sit. Back to one. That's why people go haywire.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's why we have that phrase in Zen. You know, it's the sudden realization and gradual cultivation. You know, it's not that you wake up once and then you're done. And you, oh, okay, that happened. Let's go to the beach now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you have a realization and you have to continue working on it and refining it and refining yourself.
Yeah, I knew a guy who actually once that, he felt, I said, we were talking about something about Zen. He had practiced Rinzai for a short while. I don't know if we were talking about it. I don't know if we had mentioned Kensho or something. He said, oh, well, I've already done that.
No finish line, buddy.
He'd already done that. He didn't practice it or whatever. And so I'm assuming he went to a retreat. In Rinzai, they push to produce a Kensho, a sudden realization experience. And so people can have those very premature, if you have it, prematurely, then depending on the depth of it, usually if it's premature, it's not particularly deep, which is a good thing, because if you had it suddenly, what Peter says about not knowing what to do with it, it's even more extreme. It can be completely disorienting to a person who sort of has no initiatory preparation, as it were. But anyway, but in Rinzai they do that, and they push. But usually it's not a big experience; it's a shallow awakening. But they see that as critical to the process. Where in Soto we don't emphasize that, and look much more at sort of gradual awakening. But that's the idea. But anyway. So I think he had one of those experiences, and then he figured he was the Buddha, And so, again, those are sort of the dangers you can have outside of the context of a practice with a teacher and a sangha. We can become attached to those. We can stay blissed out. We can kind of, float around in the absolute and not ever concretize our practice and our realization.
There's a story about that in Brad Warner's first book, Hardcore Zen. I think it's his first book, where he talks about, he had this dream that was really profound to him. He dreamed that he was united with God and the whole universe, and he just woke up completely blissful and was like, oh my God, this is it, this is amazing. And he took it to his teacher, and his teacher said, oh yeah, that's nice. But if he didn't have a teacher, he could have gone around thinking like, oh, I've got it. And thought that just was, that was it. That was the whole shebang.
But then what about Atadipa?
And so the dialectic continues.
I think I might have liked to have heard the Hakuin's quote at the very end. It might have just kind of brought everything you said right back to focus in that quote. I don't know if anybody else felt that way.
I did. I actually had that thought.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I liked the fact that it ended with the end of Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, before... I love the natural imagery at the end. But I would have said a couple of words about that. Is that ultimately the end of Zen? Because that's also happening in every moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was terrific.
So nobody's going to answer Doug Kayla's question?
What about Atadipa?
Yes, it's the same thing. It's happening in every moment. If you're not looking within, and when you're listening to your teacher, then you're giving your power away. And if you're not listening to your teacher, whose job it is to help you listen within, what are you listening to? What station are you tuning into? Hmm.